This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good evening, everybody. Congratulations for coming out on such a mixed night, I think we can say that. I know there's a bit of sun just at the end of the day, but it really did come down today. Although, you know, when the rain comes down at this time of the year and you have a major exhibition on in the museum, directors secretly smile inside because they think, I know everybody will be searching for a nice warm space and to see something great. And A History of the World in 100 Objects is a great show. So there's a part of me, perhaps not the best part, said, come on, rain. Good evening and thanks for joining us tonight, all of you, intrepid souls. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Matt Trinker, the Director of the National Museum of Australia. And as always here, when we commence a function at the National Museum, I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples of this land, the traditional custodians of this place on which we're meeting, and offer my respects to their elders, both past and present. I'd also like to extend that welcome acknowledgement to all other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who might be joining us tonight, and indeed to all of you. Thank you for coming out for this important discussion about the impact of immigration on Australian culture and identity. And this panel, as I'm sure you know by now, is part of an ongoing series in the Defining Moments in Australian History project, which really aims to stimulate debate and discussion about the things that matter in our national life. And as you know, you may not know, but I'll tell you, the project was launched by the NMA in 2014 with co-patrons Mr. Michael Ball and the Honourable Michael Kirby. And in consultation with a panel of eminent historians, we developed an initial list of 100 defining moments. You can see them down in the main hall. And then we asked the public to nominate their own, and the response has been astonishing, really. More than 250 extra nominations that are on our website. You can have a look at them when you get a chance, about moments in our history that people think matter, that are important to us. Now, the Australian government's 1945 post-war immigration drive features in the original list of 100 defining moments, and there's many other moments on that list that actually have a relevance when you're thinking about the nation's experience of immigration. And I think some of you will imagine, rightly, that this is a subject that has special resonance for me, because my own family on both sides came from northern Italy in the course of the remarkable 20th century, really, in Australian life. Though in my family's case, it was actually before World War II. It was in the 20s and the 30s. And it goes without saying, I think, that modern Australia is a reflection of the people from many places that have now come from abroad and joined the first Australians on this continent over the course of more than two centuries. The new arrivals have brought their cultures and their traditions, their food and their drink, thank God, their passions and their prejudices, their histories and their stories, which over time have really come to be taken into and embedded in Australian life. Some, like the early convicts, didn't necessarily come by choice. Others saw opportunity in a new land, probably like my family, and still others have fled oppression or war and made their way to Australia as a safe haven. And the path to a multicultural Australia hasn't always been smooth, as demonstrated by the ongoing public debate on immigration. But Australia, I think, is notable for having created a stable, affluent society that has successfully welcomed immigrants from more than 200 different countries around the globe. And sometimes I do think that we forget that has been, in sum, a great success. I'm looking forward to the discussion tonight, not least because of the questions that we're still wrestling with about our immigration policy and practices. The museum embraces these opportunities to debate and discuss our past. And in fact, the Defining Moments in Australian History project is all about debate and discussion, as I think you'll have learnt by now. And tonight, our esteemed panel will explore how Australian attitudes towards immigration have changed over the decades and how post-war immigration contributed to and changed Australia. And I'm now going to hand over to Paul Barclay, our host from ABC Radio National, to introduce our panellists and to begin the discussion. Thank you. Paul.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here at the National Museum. We are recording this discussion for my program, Big Ideas, on ABCRN, and it'll be broadcast, barring any last-minute changes, on Monday the 3rd of October at 8pm and available online via podcast, etc. Just further to what Matt was saying, I grew up in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne in the 1970s, where I went to a co-ed high school. In my year was a kid called George Kapanaris, who would go on to become a member of the Wogs Out of Work comedy troupe. George was one of my schoolmates, one of the many kids, actually, at my high school of Greek and Italian parents, the children of the post-war migrants. These were the kids I grew up with in my brand new high school in East Doncaster. The Italian migrants came to Melbourne, they moved into and transformed Carlton, a suburb that I hung out in my university and post-university years that I lived in. Most of those Italians then sold their tiny terrace houses to the inner city yuppies at a huge profit and moved out into the suburbs of Victoria, in my case, and there they became, really, part of the nation along with the Greeks, the Dutch, the Eastern Europeans, you name them. The Indo-Chinese refugees came post the Vietnam War in the 70s. Now we have Chinese, Indian, African, Middle Eastern migrants. Too many ethnicities, too many cultures to name. Tonight we're going to be talking about the contribution of migration to Australia and perhaps some of the tensions and policy challenges as well. We have a terrific panel of guests. Let me introduce them to you. On my immediate left, Dr. Tim Supomasan, the Race Discrimination Commissioner. Next to Tim, Amanda Vanstone, former Minister for Immigration and Multicultural Affairs from 2003 to 2007. Next to Amanda, we have Associate Professor Frank Bongiorno, author and cultural historian. Next to Frank, we have Tasneem Chopra, cultural consultant, author and prominent activist, and at the end of our panel, Marina Goh, media executive and author. Please make our guests welcome. So I thought, we live in a migrant country, why don't we get an idea of where some of our panellists came from, or where their forebears came from? My exotic migrant heritage goes back a couple of generations to Glasgow and my grandfather, the son of a blacksmith, where he was one of the many Scottish immigrants. Tim, unfortunately, you missed out on Scotland. You were born in France. And your parents were Chinese and Lao, refugees from Lao, I understand. Tell us a bit about, briefly, about your background.
As you say, my parents are from Laos. They left Laos after the communist takeover in 1975, ended up in France via a refugee camp in Thailand. They lived in France for 10 years. I was born there, but we came here when I was 3 years old. We settled in Sydney, and I still remember, as a three-year-old, stepping off the plane and being struck by this bright light. And I suspect it's a feeling that many migrants would remember upon arrival, this southern light of Australia. But my family history reflects the kind of journeys that many thousands have had in coming to Australia. We came here because we had family that had settled here in Australia, and this is how migration happens over the years, chain migration. When someone from one family settles in one place, it usually draws other members of the family later on as well.
And looking back at growing up in Australia as a young boy of Asian descent, what are your memories of that time and how you felt that you fitted into this country then?
Well, I had really two phases. In primary school, I went to a school in southwest Sydney that was predominantly Asian and non-English speaking background in composition. But when I went to high school, I was one of only a handful of Asian boys in my year. So I really got to grow up in a way such that identity became a very, very central part of of my process of coming to grips with living here and getting a sense of who I was. And this was all happening as well in high school in the 1990s, when we did have debates about Asian immigration, and when, of course, there were references to Australia being swamped by Asians. So the question of what it meant to be Australian was something that I had to grapple with as a teenager in school, and in the midst of some ugliness as well, politically and socially.
We'll talk a bit about that later on. Marina, we could, of course, spend the entire night talking about your family's story. Your mother is Northern Italian. Your father is Chinese, though his family moved to Indonesia to flee communism, and he grew up in Hong Kong. Briefly, give us an idea of your family history and how you got here.
So both of my parents are boat people, and I like to say that because, you know, the word boat people or the term boat people is used in a negative connotation, but it was very positive for my parents because they arrived here by boat. So Mum came from Italy post-war, and she was part of the exodus, I guess, from Italy in 1950, and she ended up in Newcastle and Greta Camp. My grandmother was a nurse in the war, but there, you know, obviously there was a time in history in Italy because of their own internal wars where their borders moved between old Yugoslavia and Italy, and so a lot of Mum's family live in Slovenia. So I have family in Slovenia, Croatia, and also throughout Italy. So Mum was from Trieste. So they arrived here when Mum was four. It was just her and her mother because her father was a soldier in the Italian army and he died during the war. And so they arrived and set up their life here. Mum had to go to boarding school in Maitland because her mother had to work in a factory because she couldn't speak English. And Mum was the interpreter from the age of four. So that's Mum's side of the story. My father came here as a student from Hong Kong. His family history was, you know, already quite challenged because they'd already escaped communism. And then to find themselves in a challenged environment where Dad was living in Hong Kong with foster parents, he's got a whole world of history to his family. My dad was actually given away to another family as a result of a gambling incident where his grandfather lost him in a game of mahjong. Because
I told you we could talk about this all night, the story.
Because his foster mother couldn't have sons, and, you know, sons were everything in Chinese culture and unfortunately probably still are today. And so, you know, Dad was the fourth son of his mother, and so when his grandfather lost the gambling incident, he basically agreed to hand over his next unborn child, that was happening with my dad. So that's how Dad ended up in Hong Kong, living with a different family. And, of course, he was living with a foster father who just didn't love him and he wanted to escape that, and so he came to Australia. But interestingly, the reason my mum and her mother came here was that they actually had intended to go to America. Mm. They had passports, and then their passports were stolen, and Australia was the only country that would take them without a passport. So that's how they ended up here. And then my parents met in the early 60s, fell in love, were a very rare mixed-race couple, as you might imagine, and so their early history was one of horrendous racism. So that's how my... Yeah. Yeah, that's the beginnings of my family.
And you'll need to read the first chapter of Marina's book to get the full story. I recommend it, actually.
Yeah.
Tasneem, you grew up in Bendigo in Victoria in the 1980s. You are a fifth-generation East African-born Muslim of Indian origin. What was it like growing up in Bendigo in the 1980s, given your background?
Sure. Well, I should probably... be honest and tell you, it was the 70s, not the 80s.
Okay.
To start with.
You're looking possibly young to be growing up in the 70s.
Edit the video, that's fine. At that time, back in the 70s, Bendigo, then, not as much as it is now, was a 99% Anglo-Saxon, small, middle-class country town. So I did grow up as the brown pea in a white pod, I used to say. And I went to the local state school. I went to then in high school. I moved on to the local Anglican school. So I had a very, I guess, sheltered community upbringing. And I think my parents deliberately chose moving to Bendigo after leaving Nairobi because they were coming to a new country, new culture, coming from an East to a Western concept, and had three daughters. So I think it was a no-brainer. They weren't going to go to the city when they could go to a country town and definitely have a greater control on what was happening there. So I grew up my entire life wanting to leave Bendigo and move to Melbourne, as you do, as a country child. And I did consequently move to Melbourne probably towards the end of the 80s, and by the 90s I was there. But life, and I think I mentioned this to you earlier when we spoke, life at that time and racism per se, when I did experience it, was very much centred on the superficial. It was, you look different. You know, I got called Abbo, Blackie. I got questioned why I was brown. And I did respond to the kid who said that God put me in a toaster. That's all I could think of at the time. So that was the extent of the racism that I experienced. It was never centred on my ethnicity per se, my faith. It was never centred on my spiritual beliefs. Though I was raised Muslim, that never came to the fore because at that time, and I'd say fairly much until 2001, if you were a Muslim in this country, the associations with Islam were quite unoffensive to the point where you were exotic, you were different, you know. Everyone thought Arabs were Muslims and Muslims were Arabs and that, you know, they had four wives and flying carpets. It was a very exotic, you know, innocuous racism compared to the shift, the seismic shift after 2001, when you suddenly went from being something strange to something to be feared.
And significant that you grew up in Bendigo because that, of course, in more recent times has been the site of hostile protests, I should say, against the construction of a mosque. We'll talk about, maybe not that directly, but some of the issues that are fueling that throughout the discussion. And Frank, with a surname like Bongiorno, no prizes for guessing where your mob came from.
Not from Dublin, no. So
but you didn't come in the post-war period, surprisingly,
no,
your mob.
Like the director of the National Museum, Matt Trinker, all my grandparents, all four of them, came before the Second World War, 1890s to 1920s. They're all four are from the Aeolian Islands, which is a group of volcanic islands off the coast of Sicily near Messina. We number amongst our diaspora in Australia, Bob Santamaria, Natalie Imbruglia. I could go on. I mean, you know, there's the full spectrum, really. So, I guess an interesting case in that I'm probably, I suspect, among a minority of Australians now who have two parents born in Australia. Certainly, you know, a very large number of Australians have at least one parent born overseas, and yet, of course, all four of my grandparents were from Italy. My mother's side, they were enemy aliens in the Second World War. So my mother obviously had some really interesting tales of growing up in Australia. They hadn't taken out naturalisation when they arrived in the 20s. I've actually found an application for naturalisation from my grandfather on that side in early 1940. Too late. Italy entered the war, of course, midway through that year, and it was sent back to him. So,
gee, it reminds us that everyone has a story, don't they? A migrant story. It's incredible.
Yes.
Amanda, just briefly, what's yours? You've been around. Both of your parents were born in Australia, is that right? Yeah.
I'm three quarters Irish.
Yep.
One quarter German Austrian. The Irish were not lace curtain, my mother advised me. They were, you know, bog potato farmers. Mm. Or agricultural workers, and even I'm not sure that's true either, actually, because you got a bit of assisted passage if you're an agricultural worker, and there might have been a bit of embroidery of the truth by people wanting to get out here in an inexpensive way. On the German side, I think the one I'm most fascinated by is a guy who was in his 50s. He was a hat maker and came from Bremen with his wife and daughter in her 20s. Who was, I'm not sure, widowed or divorced or whatever, and she had been married. And they came to Adelaide and met her brother, who'd obviously come ahead. And I just think coming from Bremen in the 1800s to Australia, it's a big step. And perhaps those of us who are here, because as we were discussing earlier, unless you're a full-blood Indigenous Australian, you've got migrant blood in your veins. And it's just a question of timing. Did your granny come 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, whatever? It's only timing that really makes the difference. That's We are an immigration country. That's what we are.
The story of Australia is the story of an immigration nation.
It's the story of immigration. That's who we are.
And an essentially positive story, do you think?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Not essentially, primarily. I mean, there's always, you know, a bit of bruising here and there on the carcass, if you like. But the guts of the story is a fantastic story. We've had predominantly English migration, as Tim says, because once some people come, then, you know, the next generation wants to go somewhere and their mother says, oh, we'll go there, your cousin's there. So we ended up with a lot of more English people for that reason. But back in 2009-10, India and China, who were second and third, became first and second, and the UK went to be the third source of our permanent migration. So our migration story has changed dramatically over time, but it is nonetheless a one of people, this migrant blood. That's the blood of, you've got the DNA of people who are prepared to get up and leave somewhere, family and friends, to make a better life. And that's a good story.
So, Tim, I don't want to suggest that immigration has been entirely without tension and without some periods of fear and some pockets of racism, but what's at the root, do you think, of the immigration success story in Australia? The fact that we haven't seen the type of racial conflict that's plagued other countries in Europe, plagued the UK in the 70s and 80s and France and so forth.
Well, if we confine our attention to the experience since the end of the Second World War, it's the nation-building dynamic of immigration. The fact that in the immediate years after the Second World War, we had political leadership that said we had to populate or perish. So there was a clear rationale for it. Immigration was understood as something that was to strengthen Australia and was beneficial to Australia. And it became part of the story of Reconstruction after the war. You had the long economic boom in the post-war years. And then you had an evolving as well. You obviously had primarily European migrants and refugees coming in the late 1940s, 1950s and 60s. Then you had the demise of white Australia and you had non-European migrants coming in greater number. But again, throughout, you've had this nation-building rationale for immigration. It's been something that's meant to strengthen Australia. And the other part of the success has been the citizenship that has underpinned our immigration program. People who come here, in general, have become citizens. The expectation has been that if you come here as an immigrant, you will take out Australian citizenship and you will become a full member of our society and contribute to the life of the nation.
So we made them feel welcome, essentially.
Well, sometimes it took longer than what you might have liked, but in the long view of history, yes. And that's been a very different experience to what we've had in Europe, where there have been many countries who have had significant immigration programs but have considered their migrants to be guest workers or temporary visitors. You think of Germany, for instance, where there have been millions of people of Turkish extraction who, for a long time, were unable to claim German nationality. Here, you can be an Australian citizen regardless of your race or your background, and that's been emphatically the case, especially since the end of the White Australia policy.
So, Frank, you're an historian, so you've seen the various sort of historic trends of immigration to Australia. What's been the impact overall, especially of post-war immigration on Australia? We've become fussy about our coffee. The food's improved. I don't want to be too trivial, but how has it changed us, do you think?
Yeah, the term that was used in certainly the 1980s for that aspect of multiculturalism was spaghetti and polka. And it was kind of offered as a criticism that, you know, multiculturalism should be something more substantial, I guess, than, you know, more diverse, you know, sort of leisure or restaurants or whatever. Look, you know, it has produced a much more, obviously, ethnically diverse country, but it's shifted our identity too. It is entangled in the process by which we cease to be British, I think. I mean, a point, really interesting point that's been made by the late John Hirst is that in some ways those post-war migrants who came in the 40s, 50s and 60s were really, they weren't being taught to be British. They were actually being told to be Australian. They were told they should fit in to the Australian community. And in a sense, that was different from the mainstream population. The old Australians of the 1950s still saw themselves as British. And I think that's a really interesting point. It's almost as if those migrants, particularly of the 50s, were almost pioneers in being Australian. And I think central, to come back to the points Tim just made, and he's absolutely right, I think, about, you know, Australia has shown a real talent, I think, for being able to absorb significant numbers of migrants with relatively limited conflict. The politicians were also very successful in convincing the existing population they wouldn't have to change that much. I think that's happened at a number of points along the way. It happened certainly with the post-war migration, the whole idea of assimilation, that you know, people, you know, you'd be able to bring in all these migrants from Europe and they'd fit in, they'd be absorbed. You know, that wonderful piece of, I guess, assimilationist propaganda, They're a Weird Mob, which people might have read as the popular novel or perhaps seen as the 1960s film.
Which wasn't written by a migrant.
Can you make a
hacky hat? I can't, I'm afraid. But he does a beaut job, Nino, doesn't he, in the film, the wonderful Michael Powell film. And, you know, he marries an Australian girl called Kay and you know, he's from Piedmont. You know, you couldn't get a more northern European Italian. And the whole thing is to show that, look, he's going to be just like us. And, of course, by the end of the book, he's getting as drunk as his Australian friends and he's, you know, using the same sorts of
vernacular. He's a real Aussie by then.
And I think that our politicians at different points along the way have been very good at convincing us that you could have migration on a large scale from quite diverse sources, but that they'd fit in.
Amanda. Yeah.
I think in two side views about Arthur Calwell, he did start the first immigration department, so you've got to give him great credit for that, to say, we've got to plan this, it's an essential part of who we are, and put a tremendous effort into it. He was nonetheless quite stuck with the White Australia policy, and I hadn't realised just how serious that was. I mean, there was a rule, one alien for every 10 UK, and an alien meant someone from Europe. You know, I think the probate on my great or great great grandfather's will says, you know, no proceeds of this will go to an alien. That's how we regarded European migration at that time. And he promoted it as a defence of the country. We need more people to defend ourselves against Asians in the north. And there was a very famous case of a Mrs. O'Keefe. She was Ambanese. Her name wasn't O'Keefe. And her husband was an intelligence worker, Ambanese, for the Dutch intelligence, who had a unit here in Australia. He died and Arthur Calwell wanted to kick her out. And there is a tremendous wealth of material from letters from what you call ordinary Australians writing and saying, look, mate, you know, get real here. This is not on. You can't send this woman back. And it's the O'Keefe case that I think starts the view in Australia that we will accept everybody. And our great success is, sure, it's primarily UK, China, India in varying, you know, rates over the last 10 years, but it's about, look, I don't want to put a percentage on it, but it might be 60, 70% come from hundreds of other countries. So it's the big mix that is an essential part of us being as strong as we are.
I mean, it was Arthur Calwell who advocated a surge in immigration to protect us against the threat of the yellow races, as he called them. His words, not mine, I should say.
He didn't want servicemen to be able to bring back their Japanese wives. Said, here, they can go and live in Japan. But, you know, bear in mind, he started the immigration department. He's the father of the great immigration into Australia. And I think we need to always understand people in terms of the times that they were in.
And it's a mixed story, because the populate or perish attitude that led to the mass immigration post the Second World War was driven in large part by the fear, the vulnerability that Australians felt during the Second World War, the fear of invasion by the Japanese. So we needed more people to secure the nation, didn't we, Frank? But the flip side of that was that there was still some fear of the Japanese and of the Asian races generally at the time.
Yeah, I mean, the post-war scheme is utterly bound up in the sense of a near miss in 1942, you know, this sense that Australia had been fortunate not to be invaded, and it must build up its population and build up its industry too. I mean, things like the Snowy Mountains scheme were intimately related to defence planning. They weren't just about irrigation and hydropower. They were also about atomic power at the time. And it was very much about building up the population and ensuring that you'd never have another near miss like that, that next time round Australia would be in a much better position to defend itself. So, you know, it wasn't about creating a more ethnically diverse Australia. That wasn't the motivation behind that scheme.
But it became that.
It became that.
And because you couldn't get enough migrants coming from Britain at the time, which is why they had the governments in the post-war years had to take in migrants from Europe. But even then...
The first
migrants who arrived from Europe in that post-war program were from the Baltic states, and they were chosen specifically because they would have blonde hair and blue eyes and very Nordic features, and the thinking at the time was that they would be better assimilated as a result. So what you see here is an unintended consequence of the mission of populate or perish. You couldn't sustain that mission with just British migrants through assisted passage. You had to take in European migrants. And then
assisted passage, we should say, was the £10 poem, wasn't it?
But don't forget, not only did you have to take in European people, the response to Mrs O'Keefe, she became O'Keefe because her landlord said, well, I'll marry her. If you want to kick her out, I'll marry her. That's how she became Mrs O'Keefe. And that is, I think, the point at which lots of normal Australians said, look, you know, and demanded a broader approach.
Tasmin, let me bring you back into the discussion. We can tend to get a little misty-eyed about the Australian immigration project and what it's delivered to Australia. And, of course, it has delivered a prosperous and, on the whole, tolerant country. But you believe that what we're seeing in more recent times, you know, the conventional wisdom is waves of people come here, first the Europeans, then the Asians, and that gradually over time we get used to them and it's all okay. You think, though, we've seen a bit more of a shift in recent times, a bit more of a worrying shift in attitudes towards, in particular, those people from Muslim backgrounds. Talk to that a bit, if you could, please.
Look, I'm that sociological concept of the cultural bogeyman, the new migrant who has to undergo the rites of passage, which are alienation, discrimination and whatnot. We look at the textbooks and, yes, that happened with the Greeks, it happened with the Italians, it happened with the Vietnamese, and people would look to, you know, the Middle Easterners and the Arabs and the Muslims and say, what's your turn now? Except it's been our turn for a long, long, long time. Pretty much since the Gulf War onward, and it certainly escalated after 9/11. So this is, I think it's also, it's different in the sense that with those other communities, when they were arriving post-war, it was post-war. And Australia was not involved or embroiled in any incursion or occupation of those lands as it is now with Iraq, with Afghanistan, with Syria. So there is a difference when we look at migrants from Europe who came before, you know, between up to the 70s and 80s, and we look at the, you know, migrants coming in from Afghanistan and Iraq and even Lebanon for that matter, and we associate them with, oh, we were at war with those people, we've been at loggerheads with those people, there's an economic imperative here that's actually quite nasty, quite malicious. So the associations are negative. They're not, you know, the European associations tend to be a lot lighter and fluffier, if I could, for want of a simplistic term. And so Muslims have to carry the baggage then of being the bogeyman, of being associated with who we are at war with, and representing apparently an ideology, not a religion, when it's clearly a religion. And so there's a whole host of labels thrown and thrust upon them, which they're continually expected to defend and explain or apologise for through no fault of their own. And so that is a stark difference, I think, to the passage of settlement for new migrants compared to their predecessors.
And so, okay, there is a bit of tension that has been the result of that. How much tension? As a member of the Muslim community, you were telling me, for example, that you worry about your kids going out at night at the moment.
I mean, there's literally every day there's a new worry. Today's latest worry would have been the the poll that was released, which I'm sure many of you would have read. I forget the name of the source of the poll.
The Essential Media Poll.
The Essential Media Poll.
We'll talk about that just very briefly in parenthesis. A poll of Australians asking, do you support or oppose a ban on Muslim immigration? 49% of Australians support a ban on Muslim immigration.
Yeah. Now, my first reaction to that was, well, you know, politicians ignore polls. I'm going to ignore this poll as well. no offence to matter. But on further examination, I realised this is what happens. This is where we're at. We've reached a point and a juncture where discussion of the location of the Muslim migrant in Australia as a topic that we can click on a tick box, the fact that we're a negotiable citizen, that our identity here is questionable, it has to meet certain parameters. Who writes what those parameters are? Who decides if I have a place in my own home? And the fact that we can actually be at a point where we're having this conversation is frightening.
Mm-hmm.
Because I grew up here. I mean, yes, I was Kenyan-born and of Indian origin, but I grew up in country Victoria. My roots are here. My identity is here. I have children born here. And as you mentioned, when I worry for my children because they identify as Australian, but they also identify as Muslim. But they can't pick and choose which one they're supposed to be when they walk out of the house.
Mm.
One can, because I guess to an extent she doesn't cover her head, but the second one she does cover her head. And I worry for her. I worry for a teenage girl travelling on a train in Melbourne in 2016, because that's what we've become.
Mm.
And so, yeah, where it's all going and how it's all spiralling forth, I think, has a lot to do with who gets media platform, how much political backbone do we actually have in this country where we can actually call out racism for what it is. Yes, we have free speech, but we also have... I mean, with free speech comes responsibility, and we've heard that before, but there is a responsibility when comments are made, calls for banning migration of Muslims, calls for questioning the religiosity and the validity of a particular group in our society as ones that fit in, because I say so. And when people have those platforms and they make those allegations, and there's no counterpoint to respond to them, because Muslims are silenced. They're not given an opportunity. When they are, it'll be on, you know, it'll be on page 12 at the bottom on a little comment or on some obscure, you know, radio program somewhere or some channel at 3 a.m. in the morning. There's just not the same opportunities to counter that. And I'm not excusing it, but I'm saying if you're constantly dealt with 24/7 news cycle of Muslims don't fit in, the Muslims are part of the problem, they won't integrate, and Muslims are saying, well, actually, you know what, we've actually been here since before Cook. Muslims in this country predate Captain Cook. They were the Macassan fishermen. They came here in the 1600s. They were pearl divers. We've had business people. We have CEOs of Australia Post. We have a gold Logie winner, for God's sakes. We have people doing all manner of things, but you'll pick and choose who suits your agenda because that's what sells, that's what rates, that's what's politically popular. And meanwhile, the average Australian Muslim is collateral damage.
It still strikes me, though, Marina, that when you walk outside... catch the bus, catch the train in any part of Australia, really, you are instantly made aware of the multicultural, diverse nation that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at, say, the Australian Parliament, if you look at the mainstream media, if you look at CEOs of major companies, if you look at board members mm-hmm. of major companies, it still seems to be the case that there's a lot of Anglo men, mm-hmm. not many Asian faces, not many African faces on those boards. I know this is something that is of interest to you.
It is.
Why is it the case that after so many years of migration that we haven't seen that filtering to the top, that the upper echelons of society, if you like?
Because unfortunately people appoint in their own likeness and there's an unconscious bias or conscious, because sometimes it is conscious and it's hidden, as you know, explained away as unconscious. And that's gender, race, everything, religion, what you look like. And you know, the need for diversity at board level, and, you know, I speak out about this a lot, is really so that... because actually the best ideas come from a diverse viewpoint. And people who sit around and all look the same and have come from the same backgrounds, it's groupthink. And it's the reason why things don't progress. So that's the main reason, is that people often fear what's different And so they actually appoint in their own likeness. And so for, you know, there's a lot of work that's been done, particularly with gender. And so now panels, you know, of board appointments, they have to actually have a woman on the panel, because apparently if you have a woman on the panel, you're more likely to allow a woman onto a board, which is just extraordinary that, you know, you have to do that. But I think increasingly we need to ensure that we have people from different backgrounds on board. So not just gender, it has to be from people from, you know, you need to reflect the population, actually. That's what we need to do. And at the moment that doesn't happen, and it is because of the appointment process, purely.
Yeah. And it's also to do with the default that we have with our assumptions about leadership. We have a certain assumption about what leadership should look and sound like, and unfortunately, our multiculturalism is something that is celebrated at the level of food and festivals with a lot of ease and triumphalism, but we also need to be open to having cultural diversity in our corridors of power. It's not good enough just to have it in the lunchroom or the lobby, and if we put the hard numbers on it, and we did this recently with some research, more than 10% of our population would have a non-European cultural background. It could be as high as 17%, but only 5% of ASX 200 CEOs have a non-European background, less than 5% in our federal parliament, less than 1% among our federal and state government departmental secretaries and directors general, and 2% of our university vice chancellors. And that does raise questions about whether we're doing well enough on this.
Amanda, this discussion is also about the history of migration as well, and if we go back and look at central points in our history, we've touched on the post-war migration, but of course Asian migration in the 80s caused some tensions in Australia, and I think it was 1988 when John Howard, before becoming Prime Minister, suggested that the pace of Asian immigration had outstripped community tolerance, a view I should point out that he doesn't hold now, and a view that he regrets having at the time. What do you remember about that time in the 80s where the debates around Asian immigration were rather similar to some of the debates we're having now, actually?
Well, I remember that not being a unanimous view. Very clearly remember that. I think it is worth mentioning in that context, though, that as a very new senator, I went to a Vietnamese Refugee Association meeting in Adelaide, and Mick Young, the famous Labor guy, was, I think immigration was under Special Minister of State or something then, and I remember this meeting because he specifically acknowledged me. That doesn't usually happen for new senators. You're just the bottom of the, you know, parlour nobody. And he went on and made the point that if you're in favour of immigration, and I think Malcolm's been making this point recently in New York, if you're in favour of immigration, you will keep it at a level where it has public support. And where it's going to fall over is maybe too much of one group perceived to be, but more likely people with low-income jobs worried that someone's going to come and take their job. And if you're not worried about your job or your kid's job because, you know, you went to university and everything's hunky-dory, but if you're in a family where you are worried about whether your kids are going to get a job, that is a relevant issue. And support for immigration is always higher when the country's going gangbusters, and it tapers off a bit when we hit a bit of an economic problem. And I think we need to understand and accept that we are at this fabulous experiment. I think we're the best in the world, better than the United States, maybe level with Canada in terms of having created a peaceful country. And we'll keep doing that, and that means we will have to keep our ear to the ground and not say to people, oh, you're wrong, you're an idiot, you know, blah, 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 it's all right, bring more in. You just got to keep your hand on that lever, keep pushing it up, but not so far that you lose support for it, because it's the essential Australian characteristic.
Can I just add to that? So when I grew up, my dad obviously escaped communism, and so when he arrived in Australia, he's, you know, was absolutely a Liberal voter and, you know, was terrified of Labor because of the whole campaign that Labor was, you know, communism. And so he, you know, he used to actually, he was, you know, while I was growing up, Dad was actually handing out the cards, how to vote cards at the local school. But when John Howard made those comments, he immediately changed his vote. So that's how powerful that was. And he still has a real horrible kind of feeling towards him as a politician purely because of that particular comment around Asian immigration.
And, of course, the irony being that John Howard's seat ended up being populated by a very high proportion of Asian voters. It was an interesting part of our history, though, Frank, wasn't it, the 80s? I was just thinking about how much the attitudes in the 80s presaged some of the comments of Pauline Hanson in 1996 about being swamped by Asians. And just remind people of historian Geoffrey Blainey's speech in 1984, where he spoke of how regrettable it was that the Hawke government were bringing in new migrants into areas of high unemployment. He criticised the levels of Asian immigration and said, "I do not accept the view widely held in the federal cabinet that some kind of slow Asian takeover of Australia is inevitable." This really triggered a massive debate, didn't it, in the 80s?
It did, and to be fair to John Howard, of course, he was quite critical in 1984 in lowering the temperature of that debate. There was a moment in the federal parliament in May 1984 when one Labor member, actually, who'd spent the Second World War in Yugoslavia under Nazi occupation and so on, actually got very excited and started jumping over the seats to have a more physical confrontation with, the Liberal members on the other side over this very issue. It was a debate over, essentially, the issues that had been raised by Blainey. But, yes, he did. I mean, he made a speech to a Rotary meeting in Warrnambool in early 1984, March, I think, in which he described Asian migrants as a favoured or the favoured majority. And it wasn't accurate because Asians weren't, of course, a majority of the migrant intake at that stage. But it did provoke a debate that I think exposed many of the anxieties in Australian society about the shifting profile of the immigration intake. I mean, we need to keep in mind, I think, that this was the first time for a century that there'd been substantial Asian migration to Australia. I mean, I think the previous large intake had been in the 1870s and the Palmer River gold rushes in Queensland, in northern Australia. So, this was, if we're talking about defining moments, that period from about 1976 onwards was very much a defining moment in Australian history. It one of the ways in which people had thought about being an Australian up till then was you weren't Asian. Mm. To be not Asian was kind of to be Australian. And I think, obviously, the shifting nature of the immigration intake in the 70s and early 80s really challenged that idea. And in a lot of ways, the politicians, again, they'd abolished the White Australia policy, but had been perhaps not very forthcoming in explaining what this would actually mean for the country, that this would mean, in fact, a very different form of national identity. And I think the debates of 1984 and then again 1988, and indeed you could argue 1996 with Hanson and beyond, were very much about the playing out, I think, of those sorts of tensions and a lot of unspoken things about what this change meant.
And fast forward to today, and Indian and Chinese migration to Australia right now is greater than UK immigration, which gives you an idea of quite how profoundly the country has changed. I think, Amanda, you wanted to make a point.
I asked the Parliamentary Library to see if they could find a cartoon. I swear I didn't invent this in my head. I've seen this cartoon. I'd pay a reasonable amount of money if someone could find it. because, Fraser set up the multicultural blah, blah. And so there he is. What do you call it, a Burns night? That Scottish thing?
Burns night,
okay.
Oh, Bobby Burns.
So there
Bobby
they are.
Burns, yes.
There's two guys, Fraser and some other old geezer, standing there in their kilts, the frilly shirts, the sort of velvet jackets, all done up like girls sort of thing. And one guy is saying to Fraser, "I don't know about letting these people bring all their different customs in here, it was a fabulous cartoon. I would just love to have it. And it's true that the white Anglo-Saxons didn't see themselves as bringing new customs here. Mm. They were just in charge. And it took some time to adjust to the fact that, they did bring new customs and to realise that our strength is in welcoming all of them.
I think that's a really good point, because multiculturalism assumes that migrants will come here, sure, they will contribute and they will become a part of the nation, but that they will also, over time, change the nation, that their culture, by its very presence here, will make us a different country. That's a kind of delicate balancing act, isn't it, Tim, that we have to get right? You know, because Australians like the country they live in now. They don't want too much change. But by the same token, I don't know that there are too many Australians who would want to go back to the 1950s either. How well have we done at striking that balance?
We've done really well. And the key to that is with how our multiculturalism has evolved. Our multiculturalism hasn't meant open slather. It hasn't given people license to do whatever they like and justify it in the name of their culture. It's meant very clearly the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. Everyone has a right to express their cultural identity and heritage, but that's accompanied by civic responsibilities, a commitment to our parliamentary democracy, an acceptance of the rule of law, equality of the sexes. The other point to add here is that it can take time before we can appreciate the two-way street of cultural diversity and multicultural reality. If you think about, I hate to go to the culinary aspects of multiculturalism, but indulge me for a brief moment. The cappuccino is the most commonly consumed hot beverage in our country. The most popular takeout option is arguably Thai. Now, these would have been inconceivable for any Australian living here in 1947 to think that these cultural changes would have occurred and would be accepted and celebrated as part of everyday life. But the challenge here is to get, of course, beyond just the superficialities and to ensure that if we are learning from other cultures, it is something that has depth to it, and it is something that involves us reflecting on our values as a society that takes fairness seriously, that thinks very seriously about ourselves, is egalitarian, and is open to welcoming people from all quarters.
Look, there is so much to talk about under the banner of immigration. I'm realising that there's so much I won't have time to talk about. I'm not even sure whether we'll be able to get on to discuss refugees just given the time. Maybe we will. But I do want to come to that essential media poll that was just published. So Essential Media have published a poll that appears, I think, in the newspapers today. 49%, as I said, of Australians support a ban on Muslim immigration to Australia. What's interesting is that 40% of Labor voters support a ban, 60% of LNP voters support a ban, 34% of Green voters support a ban on Muslim immigration. And the reasons that they support the ban? 41% of respondents say that Muslims don't integrate into Australian society. 22% say that they don't share our values. So there you have 63% of respondents basically saying that Muslims don't either integrate or share our values, and 27% say that they support the ban because of the terrorist threat. Tasneem, what did you make of those figures? I mean, we've for so long the discussion around Pauline Hanson since she was re-elected into the Senate was that she was supported by a tiny rump of people in Australia. Do these figures give lie to that, do you think?
What those figures suggest to me is that propaganda is a popular thing. And it also suggests that if you say a lie enough times, people will believe it. If you tell people enough times on enough platforms, enough times in a day, enough times in a week, and enough times in a month, repeatedly, that Australian Muslims don't integrate, they don't fit in, their values don't accord with ours. And that is all that you are hearing, because you're not hearing a counterpoint. If Sonia Kruger is on primetime television telling you that as a mother she's worried for her children, when there's no opportunity for an Australian Muslim mother to say, well, you know, Sonia, I'm worried as well. I'm worried because my kid can't get on a train safely. I'm worried not because of, yes, I'm also worried about a terrorist threat, but I'm also worried for the day-to-day realities and hostilities that as a second and third and fourth generation migrant, I will now have to counter because I look different to you, and that is all. So these statistics show me, and the outcomes of this poll say that the media, propaganda, are a very convincing machine, and they can dictate between headlines and soundbites and opportunities, who is marginalised and who is pilloried and who is not. So I don't get to write the media, but someone out there in Anglo-Saxon middle-class male world does. And I'm continuously going to be... I'm going to occupy 98% of the new space and make up 2% of the population. And that's just... I'm just used to that.
Diversity of editors, that's what we need.
Yeah.
So we also need political leadership here. It's fundamentally important that we stay true to our values as a society. We are a liberal democracy. We should be committed to a principle of non-discrimination, and we should be committed to tolerance. And if political leaders are looking at this poll today, they should be thinking about leading and shaping public opinion and not following it, because we will have periods in our national life when our multiculturalism and our status as an immigration nation will come under challenge. We've seen that with Jeffrey Blaney and John Howard in the 1980s. We've seen it with Pauline Hanson, Mark One in the 1990s. We are perhaps seeing it again. But think about this. In 1947, 58% of people polled in Australia said that Australia should not accept Jewish refugees. If we were to have followed public opinion, we may not have had the kind of nation-building experience and project that we've enjoyed in the past 8 decades. This is the time for political leadership to reassert itself and ensure that there isn't a vacuum when it concerns race, immigration and multiculturalism. There's too much at stake.
Can I just say...
Tasneem and then Amanda.
I think that's a very important point, Tim, and I made a comment earlier this week that during that maiden speech, if that particular MP, a senator rather, had made the comments of we should ban immigration, we should question the integrity of integration of these people, etc. But if she had used the word Jewish and not Muslim, I'm just saying hypothetically, the backlash against her for anti-Semitism would have been profound. It would have been across all levels. But somehow, Islamophobia doesn't rape. In some quarters, there were responses from Labor backbenchers and certainly independents, some Greens. But from government, I'm yet to hear a strong condemnation of that. As you know what, you're entitled to your views, but they're tantamount. They're racist, and they're bigotry, and that's not what this country was built on. And in fact, those kind of comments will incite violence, will incite hatred, and will incite results to a poll that we've just seen.
I'm intrigued whether Pauline Hanson still thinks that Australians are being swamped by Asians. It's an obvious question to ask, isn't it, given that, essentially it's the same template and she's just substituted...
I think the Asian Muslims, though, she's probably
terrified.
Other
Asian Muslims.
Terrified. Absolutely.
Amanda, I won't get you to speak for the government, obviously, but... would you like to respond to...
I think I forgot what I was going to say earlier, because we've got a bit sidetracked. I do agree with Tim that it's important to show leadership and not just follow an opinion poll, albeit this is a divided poll. It's a very worrying one. It is time to show leadership. But I also think we don't want to pretend that there aren't people who are genuinely apprehensive about terrorist attacks, and we don't want to pretend that they are largely perpetrated by people who want to join ISIS or, get hooked up with and are of Islamic faith. And that's, if you like, the elephant in the room that people don't like to address. There are people who have genuine... I'm not going to the grand final this year, but I remember last year thinking, oh, gee, if I was a terrorist, this is where I'd do it, And it's a mistake to... Well, I agree we need to show leadership for all the right reasons. I agree entirely with you. But it is a mistake to say to the people who have those genuine apprehensions about big public events and big public places, you're an idiot, there's nothing wrong. Yeah. We need to address those fears, to understand them and work with them to show leadership that way. And my own view is it's by the putting down of people who have that genuine apprehension, Hillary calling the Trump people a basket of... What she call them? A basket of...
Deplorables.
It just shows the condescension that some people have towards citizens who have a different view. And if you keep treating people that way, you know what they'll do? They'll go and support someone like Trump. I think that's what's happened. These people are just sick of not being listened to, and not being treated as if they've got a genuine view. And so they go and, you know, I mean, you don't accept that pressure, let some pressure out of that valve and you'll get a Trump.
Okay, I'm determined to finish on a positive note before we finish with some questions. And Marina, I thought I'd come to you. Migrants have come to Australia for a better life for decades and decades, for a better life for their kids in particular. Frequently, it's the Australian-born kids of these migrants who outperform the local kids. We're seeing that. And frequently you see them grasp the nettle of the opportunities that are in front of them because their parents made the decision to come here. You are a prime example, I think, of that, your parents and the adversity that they experienced. Do you see a direct line between that adversity and the drive and the success that you've managed to achieve in Australia?
Well, I've always said that my personal drive, and I do have a crazy personal drive, has come from my father. And he always had this drive and he always had this determination to make something from nothing, because both of my parents had absolutely nothing when they got married. And they created a life for themselves, and they were determined that their children would be well educated and have the opportunities that they didn't have. And we grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney, so we didn't come from an affluent background. But we worked really hard, and my dad is really proud of the fact that I not only went to university, but I also did postgraduate studies. I have an MBA. And for him, it was all about making sure that his children did better than he did. And I think, absolutely, I saw how hard they worked. I saw, my dad worked three jobs when I was young, and he was hardly ever around. And I just never forget that, and I really appreciate it. And I think so do my siblings. I mean, we really value what our parents have done for us.
Mm. Okay. A fabulous point, I think, to end the discussion on. I've taken up too much time, so we have scarcely no time left for questions, but we do have some time for one or two. So, and I think we have a microphone around that someone can bring to you if you'd like to ask a question in the short amount of time we have left. Whack up your hand. I think we had one of the two in the front. And
is it?
Okay.
Seven?
We'll
on?
Take the question here and then maybe up the back.
I just want to make one point and then a question if I could.
Briefly, if you can. Thank
the
you.
Point is that up until the 1980s, most of our migration that came to Australia was directed to projects such as the Snowy Scheme, or inland or other areas. They didn't enclave themselves in the major cities. That therefore allowed more people to accept them because they were not really in the cities. My question is this. We want people to come, or people want to come to Australia because of our values and our culture and our system. Why therefore would they want to impose their values on us, which has recently been done when they tried to change the Family Court Act?
Tim, do you want to have a go at that?
Look, I'm not aware of the legal reform to which you refer, but can I say, when there's talk about migrants imposing their values on Australia, I think of my own experience and my family naturalised as Australian citizens after being here for 3 years, and I can tell you I grew up with my parents telling me constantly that I am an Australian. You are an Australian. That's what they used to say to me. And we became Australian when we got our citizenship certificate. And I think of all those Australians who become citizens and they take a loyalty pledge to this country, which native-born Australians do not take. They become Australians by choice. They say, I pledge my loyalty to Australia and its people, whose democratic beliefs I share, whose rights and liberties I respect, whose laws I will uphold and obey. That's the contract, and in my view, if we appreciated that reality of migration and the challenge of leaving your country, leaving everything behind, making a new start here, and thinking about the future of your children and your grandchildren, I suspect many of the anxieties that may be out there would be very easily allayed.
Yeah, can I just also add to that? Thank you, Tim. Can I also add to that, when you talk about these particular migrant groups, if hypothetically you were speaking about Muslims, I would say to that people have constantly made this allegation that Muslims want to bring their values. I've yet to see a charter of what those values are, but from the way that I was brought up and from the nuances and understandings that I've had with the Muslims in this country that I know, which I would venture to say are a lot more than most of the people in this room, is that the values they share are the same as yours: universal goodwill, understanding, peace, tolerance, respect for authority and respect for the country in which you live. If you're talking about the imposition of Sharia and Sharia values, again, I've yet myself to meet a Muslim who wants to introduce Sharia. Don't quite know what that means. It sounds very sensational. It sounds scary. I'd be scared too. Having said that, if you look at the minutiae of Sharia, which isn't just a pocketbook of rules and laws, it maintains that you have to follow the law of the land you live in. So if you're a Muslim and you're following Sharia, you are following the codebook of the Australian Constitution by definition of being a good Muslim. That's what following the values means.
Okay, one more question. I think we should take the question at the back so that we have one from the front and one from the back.
This is mainly for Tim, Tasneem and Mariana, but the others as well. What do you think of the question, where are you from? And what are your strategies to answer? For Mariana specifically, how do you feel about being called mixed?
I guess I've become used to it, actually. I just think that people don't understand, you know, and so I just say, because people do say that to me all the time, where are you from? And, you know, and also my children. My husband is Scottish, Irish, Australian, and so I have one child who is blonde hair, blue eyes, and I have one child who looks quite very Asian, actually much more Asian than me. And you know, so people used to say to me, do they have dads, you know, that sort of thing, which is really rude. That's more offensive, actually. I was born here, and I just assume that people don't really understand, and I try not to take too offence to it, really. Just try and educate people.
Context and who's asking and where. I mean, I usually play with it. And I mean, if people ask me where I'm from, I tell them Faulkner, which is a suburb in Melbourne. And they're going to be, where are you really from? And I'm like, Bendigo. And they're like, no, where are you from? And so then I'll tell them. But then it depends. I used to work for government and government service, and I'd have clients that come to the door. And if they were Indian looking and they could see me and I could tell, oh, this is going to end up in a favour situation, and they'd ask me where I'm from, I'd tell them Kenya. And when I've had East African clients and they've asked me where I'm from, I'm from India. So I do throw it around, and I guess I'm ethnically ambiguous to that extent. I have, when I worked for an MP in Parliament, and I used to be there during sitting week in here in Canberra, I should say, there were many times I'd be walking through the halls of Parliament, and I would actually be stopped and asked if I was lost from, you know, with my delegation and my tour from the middle. Yeah, so.
Okay, and quickly, Tim.
Yeah, it really depends, and most of the time when people ask that question, it's born of curiosity, and it's asked in goodwill, and I wouldn't want us to be punishing goodwill or curiosity, but of course a lot depends on the manner in which it's asked, and when it's asked. If it's the first thing that people ask of you, I can understand why people may feel, well, why don't you want to ask other aspects about who I am before you get to that? Because quite often we're all very happy, I think, to share information and to tell people where our family's from. Let's have a normal conversation as well and not be bogged down by that.
Okay, look, it's been a terrific conversation. Managed to talk about immigration for an hour and a quarter without talking about refugees, which is pretty impressive. I think that's probably worth a whole discussion on itself, however. But it's been a terrific evening, and I want to thank the National Museum for putting it on yet again, and I'll hand back to Matt to wrap up the evening.
Thanks, Paul, and thanks to our great panellists. I'm reminded, just listening to that last question, that in my own experience, when I'm in Australia, I'm Italian, and when I'm in Italy, I'm Australian. So I think it's terribly useful, I have to say, at certain times. I'd just like to thank the Honourable Amanda Vanstone, Dr. Tim Soutphommasane, Marina Goh, Tasneem Chopra, Frank Buongiorno, and, of course, Paul Barclay. Giving our panellists a catalogue to a history of the world in 100 objects and some free tickets. Can't hand them out to all of you, of course, but special thanks to them. Can I encourage you to visit the show, though? Thank you for being such an attentive and great audience. This is a subject, truly, that you could speak about all night. But I do think it's one of the great strengths of this society that we talk about these matters, that we discuss them, we wrangle about them, often we disagree, but just as often we come to some resolution and move forward. We're a terribly pragmatic nation, ultimately, I think, in Australia, and I think we should rely on that, especially at times of stress and concern like this when we see the results of a poll of the sort that we've seen today. This panel, just to remind you, will be broadcast on Monday, the 3rd of October, on RN's Big Ideas program at 8 p.m, so listen in. I'd like to invite you all now to join our panel members downstairs in the bay window for complimentary refreshments. Thanks very much to our wine sponsors, Capital Wines, who always sponsor these events. If you enjoyed tonight's discussion, please join us again here on October 11th for another Radio National panel. That one themed around the current exhibition, A History of the World in 100 Objects, sadly hosted by another great Radio National talent, Fran Kelly, but missing our favoured son here, Paul Barclay, who's been so good to the National Museum. Thanks again, Paul. Thank you and good night.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.